Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust.
Hey, it's January 2021, and I'm not going to hide my excitement that it's not 2020 anymore. That was terrible, and let's never do that again. Of course, I say that somewhat ironically because I think we all know that 2021 started where 2020 left off, and we're having some pretty rough times as emergency physicians and just as members of this community of humanity that wants to keep as many people alive as possible. So happy new year to y'all, and thanks for surviving last year and for helping so many of our colleagues and our communities survive as well and thrive. And hopefully 2021 things will take a turn for the better, especially with the vaccines for coronavirus now being rolled out and right on the front cover of the January 2021 ASAP Now, the official voice of emergency medicine, I should mention. We've got the top right column on the front page, coronavirus vaccinations begin among frontline workers. And this is by Josh Nefarados, who helps me do Brief 19, a blog that covers the COVID space. And we wanted to go through and answer some questions about the vaccines that you might have and that your family might have as the rollout actually expands from the frontline healthcare workers all the way out to members of our communities who we need to get this vaccine as well. And like it or not, we are going to be asked these questions over and over, and we should do everything we can to help people understand what they need to understand in order to get vaccinated. Let's talk about the first three big questions that we think everyone wants to know about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccinations, which are, as of now, the two vaccines that have authorization for emergency use here in the United States. And here are the questions. Number one, should I get the vaccine when it is available to me? Number two, should I be vaccinated if I was already infected with coronavirus and I recovered? And three, which vaccine is best? Now, the answer to the first question in most cases is pretty straightforward, we feel, compared to getting COVID-19 itself, which even in January of 2021 has already killed over 1 in 1,000 Americans. The side effects associated with the vaccines, which are admittedly somewhat reactogenic, they're minor, but they're annoying. There's no comparison. You do not want COVID-19, and you want to be vaccinated because, again, the very worst case scenario with the vaccine we know so far is that a very rare case of anaphylaxis has been known to occur. Epi was used. The patients who had allergies were mostly the ones who cropped up for this, but even patients who have allergies to other vaccines have done just fine with this. And of course, I'm sure by now many of you listening to this had your vaccinations. If you're like me and you had the vaccine and you didn't love it, that's okay. I'm gonna say, knocked on my ass, if you will, for a couple of days after it. I had a mild case of what I am calling manaphylaxis. And that's a trademark term that I made up when I was spiking a fever and shaking in my hoodie sweatshirt on the couch and taking some Tylenol. I will say that the Tylenol really knocked it out. Usually, if I get sick, yeah, the antipyretics, they help, but they don't knock it out. But I took a dose of Tylenol, and I think I did Advil the second time, and both times just really took care of it on a couple of doses. So that's good news, is that yes, they're reactogenic, they cause side effects, but the thing that it's preventing is obviously lethal in a lot of cases, not to mention what we're learning about long COVID and these subacute problems. You look at the Chinese study in Lancet, I think it was, from January as well. Very high rates of patients have scarring on their lungs at 6 months out. Their pulmonary function tests are not what they should be. They report difficulty with exercise. Then there's the people who were in the ICU who have all kinds of post-ICU kinds of symptoms, which can include some depression. This is really a problem, and if vaccination can reduce any of this, they're for it. Okay, so then number two, the second question, which was, if you've had coronavirus before, should you actually get vaccinated again? And we're going with yes. The guidance is now yes, but not when you are still recovering. So once you're fully recovered, then yes, you should be vaccinated. And it's actually possible, I did not know this, but vaccination can actually provide a stronger and longer lasting immunity than natural infection in some diseases. And that might be the case here. There's some signal of that in the sort of early phase of these trials, that the titers among people who had recovered was actually lower than people who had the vaccine at the same number of days out, if you will. And then which vaccine is best? And for that one, let's say it's complicated. If the question is, which one should I get? The answer that we're going with is get the one that's available to you now, immediately, because dying is not what we want. Just get one of them, unless you have a severe allergy to one of the ingredients. And then we'll talk about some other difficulties like pregnancy in a few minutes. But honestly, get the one that you can. Like, I actually, when I went to get my vaccine, I thought I was getting Moderna because, honestly, the CEO of my hospital is on the board of Moderna. So I was like, I guess I'm getting Moderna. Turns out I got Pfizer. I was like, oh, by the way, what was that? And they were like, oh, that was Pfizer. I was like, oh, okay, who knew? So get the one that you can get. But there are some differences. And I think that if you do want to get granular, we do talk about that in this article. And I just want to take you through the table that's actually, it's not in the print magazine, we actually put it online, but it does get at some of the differences. And I don't think that anyone's going to memorize what I tell you here in this podcast, but if I say it here, you'll know that there's a difference between the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines. And first of all, Pfizer checked theirs in people 16 or older, and Moderna 18 and older. And the storage temperature is one thing, just in terms of just practicality. The Pfizer one needs to be at super duper cold temps, so minus 80 Celsius, and that's compared to Moderna, which is minus 25. The doses, I think we all know that it's either 21 or 28 days. The Pfizer is the 21 days. And interestingly enough, the efficacy, I think we've all kind of settled on whatever, close to 94%. But the one thing that I think people really are interested in is efficacy between the first and second dose. Now, it's important to realize that we don't know how long that lasts and whether it just go up over time, because quite frankly, efficacy has a lot to do with how quickly people in the placebo arm became infected and had symptoms of COVID-19. So it just takes time for the numbers to add up. We do see the curve separate, you know, a couple weeks out. So that's where you start to see the effect. Interesting, though, that the Pfizer, if you look really deep into the data, Pfizer is about 50% efficacy between the first and second dose. And for Moderna, reported as only receiving the first dose, the first 14 days, you have about 50% efficacy. And then after 14 days, up till I think day 28 is when they looked, it was 92% effective with just the one dose. The problem, of course, is that we don't know how long that'll last. These vaccines were designed in rapid time, but they also were looked at in terms of whether their titers would require a booster, looking at some animal studies. And so that's why these two rounds were determined to be necessary. And the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that is now being looked at as well is interesting because it will not need that, we think. They're comparing one and two doses, so we're going to get a good readout on that, and we're going to find out how that goes. But getting a little bit more into the granular details on this, I do think that we should mention that they did look at a subgroup analysis, and that this was important because for the most part, the two vaccines are pretty similar and they do the same stuff, but the efficacy after the second dose, for people over 65, there's a bit of a consideration here. And the Pfizer-BioNTech had a 94.7% efficacy after the second dose, which is indeed higher than what was seen in the Moderna group. The 65 plus who got Moderna, 86.4% efficacy. Okay, so 94.7% versus 86.4%, still both very good. I would still get whichever one you can get. But if you strictly wanted to be on the numbers, for the older population, there's that slight edge in the Pfizer group. And of course, the confidence intervals could be responsible for some of this, but quite frankly, the confidence intervals also in the Pfizer group were higher. So up to 99% on the 95% confidence interval for the Pfizer, up to 95% on the 95% confidence interval for Moderna. Did you catch all that? It's okay. If you didn't, it's online. That's why we have the interwebs. And speaking of COVID-19, let's stay with that just for a little while. In the By the Numbers space of the magazine, we have some data from some surveys of some emergency department medical directors related to COVID-19 issues. And this covered some rural, some urban, and some suburban facilities. So we got a good representation in this By the Numbers survey. And we have some really interesting information about whether or not patients are unable to be placed in isolation. Because this is a big concern, right? Because it's the hallway patient is no longer okay if they've got active COVID-19. So I thought this question was really interesting to ask medical directors. How often are you having to put patients who might have COVID-19 out there, unable to isolate them? And so is it never? Has it happened once or twice? Does it happen every day? Does it happen multiple times a day? And for both patients with COVID-19 symptoms and confirmed COVID-19, there were ED directors who said, yeah, never once have I had to place these patients in a place other than isolation. But actually, much more common were people saying it happens every day and even multiple times a day. And I think that's the experience, that by the time you figure out that some patient with abdominal pain also has shortness of breath, it's like they've been out there in the hallway for a while. So this is a real problem. That's why masks are so important. And then another question that was reported here was about COVID-19 related medicine shortages. And obviously this is going to be a bigger problem with more cases, but let's go through these numbers. 17% said there was a remdesivir shortage at some time. 21% said there was a convalescent plasma or serum problem or shortage at any given time. Scary to me, 8% said there was a shortage of steroids at any given time. And I say that one is particularly scary because steroids, dexamethasone, is really, as far as anyone knows at this time, the only known treatment that has a mortality benefit in patients with any kind of COVID, especially in the patients who have hypoxia, of course. Only in the patients who have hypoxia, I should say, because the patients who are normoxic actually trended towards worse. But the point is that for 8% to say that there's a steroid shortage, that's a problem. Again, we can't run out of that one. I found this interesting that 29% of respondents said that there was shortages related to monoclonal antibodies. I didn't know that many people were trying to give it out, but so great, more power to you. So that's obviously something that we're keeping an eye on, are these shortages. The biggest shortage, of course, is not a medication. We would just be worried about staff and ventilators. That's the hospital capacity. That's the stuff that I think over the next few weeks is going to be tricky and difficult. Okay, and of course, don't forget the PPE. We always have to remember that PPE is an issue. And it's amazing to think that a year ago it wasn't, and now all of a sudden we're rationing PPE all over this country. But let's move on to a non-clinical topic. ACEP delivers on out-of-network billing, and this was a very late-breaking story. End of 2020, kind of last-minute thing, the House of Representatives and the Senate got it together to sign this huge bill that also included an out-of-network billing compromise, and this was something that ACEP worked on for a long time, and so to see this come through at the last minute was really a great thing for the college, great thing for our specialty, and it really could have been a major problem. So really hats off to the people who made this happen on the ACEP side, a lot of advocacy, really getting the patients out of the middle. You don't want to have the situation where patients are getting these bills and they weren't expecting them, they even had insurance. So the legislation really does achieve two major things. Number one, protecting patients from unexpected medical bills when they come to see us in the emergency department. And number two, incentivizing insurers to keep providers in network. And on top of that, they also have to pay reasonably when unexpected out-of-network care occurs. A lot of details to go through here, but the thing to know, I think, the big take-home is arbitration. This law sets up the idea of simplified arbitration or an independent dispute resolution if the insurers don't make a fair initial payment. So there's a whole lot of bells and whistles here that I want you to go through, but one thing that I think a lot of people wanted to know is that does it prohibit the arbiter from considering Medicare and Medicaid rates? And the answer is it does. It prohibits the arbitrator from considering Medicare and Medicaid rates when determining a fair payment for commercial claims. And this had been a big sticking point. Oh, what percentage of Medicare and Medicaid would these things be? And that actually is not how it ended up being. So there's a whole discussion about what the payments can be and what the medians can be, and can the insurers, how can they be kept from manipulating that? But I'll let you read the article, but it's really great work. And the DC ASAP staff and the members and lobbyists on the Hill, kudos, because this could have been a real disaster for us. And it turned out to be, I think, a reasonable compromise given everything that's gone down in the past. And on top of that, we had also heard that there was some major cuts heading our way in terms of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the physician fee schedule. And there was going to be this really big hit to the kinds of care that we provide. But in a last-minute intervention by Congress, it looks like things are a lot better. Again, ASAP advocacy really coming up. Sometimes I think people don't know what we're paying for with our dues because we don't hear about this stuff. And it's going on, and it matters. So those are the policy updates. Let's talk a little bit about other things that are in the magazine. On the front cover, by the way, I just wanted to mention, I've got a great picture here of Lauren Westerfer and an article that goes with it by Jordana Haber about virtual conferences. And is this a blessing for women? And the pandemic has really brought in the era of Zoom. So it was great to hear from Jordana Haber on that and how the idea of a remote conference in one way could be really helpful. In other ways, it can be hard because during the pandemic, so many things are falling to women even more than usual. So it's been a real problem. And on the other hand, hey, it's great to not have to travel to these conferences. So there's a little bit of a give and take there. And they got this picture here of my good friend, Dr. Westerfer, and her two kids at the ASAP 20 convention right there at their home in Massachusetts. So what else do we have in the magazine? We've got a really nice piece, my personal favorite way to get IV access, the IO, the interosseous approach. And there are some myths about this. And so Christopher Sampson, a friend of mine and ASAP, a fellow of the college, wrote a nice myth-busting column for us here. Five myths. Number one myth, the proximal tibia is the only location. Oh no, you can go to the humerus, you can go to the iliac crest, even the sternum. So there are other places to go. He talks about what medications you can use. I think the big thing is that people feel like, oh, you can't get blood products. Yeah, you can. And so there's a couple other things there to take a look at as well. Great article on artificial intelligence, AI. I greenlit this article by my good old friend, Dr. Nupur Garg, a resident colleague of mine from back in the day. Now we're both out in the world in post-residency life, but Dr. Garg is an expert on this. And this is a really interesting article about artificial intelligence. And the take home is that AI is not as bad as you think, but more importantly, it's coming. So there's going to be medical decision-making, there's going to be billing, there's going to be all kinds of things that AI is involved with in our lives as physicians. And what Dr. Garg, what Nupur is telling us to do is to get in the conversation, because if we're not part of that conversation, AI will work on us as opposed to working for us. So I like that kind of approach, and that's why we put it in the magazine. As usual, we have our great casework from EM Cases and from Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, the Canadians, Anton Hellman and Ken Milne, two physicians I enjoy having a beverage with when we're allowed to do that in person. And then also wanted to give a plug for this really important article in the Forensic Facts column by Ralph Raviello and Heather Rotzi, who are both FaceApps as well, both fellows of the college. And this is a really interesting article about sex trafficking, child sex trafficking, especially we think about young teens and how to pick that up in the emergency department, and some really key points there, because sometimes the emergency department is just about the only opportunity to see patients or individuals who are victims of sex trafficking. And so we actually do nowadays have the institutional resources and the community resources to help these individuals, and we want to do that. This is a great article that can help you figure out the right way to set up trust between you and the patient and some of the resources that you'll need. And then rounding it out here is Medical Legal Mind from Dr. Gita Pensa. the medical legal mind, as I think you may know, I break this up into two platooning columnists. Dr. Pensa does the litigation side, and Dr. Eric Funk does the M&M, if you will, the cases that didn't go great. And it looks through how the jury found in some lawsuit, or looking at charts. Really, I think it's an important column, and I'm glad we're doing it. And this one by Dr. Pensa is about when you should not go to trial. It's hard because sometimes you think you didn't do anything wrong. But as she points out, it's not about that. It's not about did you do anything wrong. It's about winning or losing. She walks through how difficult that can be and how to make that choice with your team. But as usual, we never want to stigmatize litigation. This is a part of our practice, and it's unfortunate when people have bad outcomes, but we also know that being an emergency doctor, there's something of a numbers game, and sometimes your number comes up and it's through no fault of your own. Of course, there are situations where you wish you could do something different and hopefully no one got harmed, but that's why this column I think is so important, because we do talk about the logistics of how to get through that very difficult period of being involved in a legal proceeding. Is that all we have in the magazine? No, there's news from the college, there's case reports, and there's other great stuff. So please check it out in your inbox or online ASAP now. And as always, pitch me your articles, pitch me your ideas. Let me know what you'd like us to cover more of. Maybe you're sick and tired of some of the stuff. Maybe you say, hey Faust, no more COVID. I'm not sure how I'm going to respond to that one, because I think COVID's kind of like here to stay for a little while longer, but I do definitely take your feedback. So all kidding aside, let me know what you'd like to see, what you'd like to hear, and we will make it happen. This is all about getting the great work that our colleagues do, both in the clinical environment and the advocacy space, into the community, into our ears, into our brains and our minds, so that we can do our jobs that much better. That's what we're all about. So thanks for listening, and I will see you next time on ASAP Nowcast. ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.